Spirit Radio Podcasts. The best of the morning show on Spirit Radio.
It may be February, spring is in the air, but when it comes to gardening, we have to be careful not to get ahead of ourselves. I talked to Anne-Marie Baring of Dalkey Garden School.
The old guys, the old farmers have been in round would always say, February? February's the one you got to be careful about. You
absolutely
know?
But I mean, that's the interesting thing, because for quite a few years we had mild winters,
yeah,
and then and sort of mild summers, and people started planting plants in their gardens. I think one of the big things was tree ferns became very popular, which are beautiful plants, and they were planted in really lovely locations, etc., and suddenly we had this massive snow and they all died.
Yeah.
So you know, we think, you know, we're talking about climate change and our plants in our gardens and things dying and not being able to cope with the changes. We get tricked into thinking that everything is mild and we can plant this, plant that, but we can't. We have to work and with nature, with what the environment wants, because weather, climate is what we have and weather is what we get.
Yes.
Isn't that what they say?
Exactly.
You know?
And you know, I'm just going back to where I'm from or where I live. We had a snow that stayed for 3 weeks, three foot deep in 2009, for 4 weeks at the end of 2010. Remember the Beast from the East?
Yes.
I mean, that was literally up the height of the door. We opened the door and there was just an imprint of the door.
It was such fun, wasn't it?
It was just like, but everything in the garden, 2009, 2010, and everything dies. Yeah. Now we've got it sorted so that we don't.
Well, but, see, plants that are long-lived, that have really deep roots. I always remember seeing my friend's garden in Galway, and they had a massive big gristlinia hedge, which was this evergreen hedge. It was very, very old, and it was totally destroyed.
No.
But it was a well-established plant,
and
they left it, and it's totally regrown.
Wow, that's amazing.
You know, so that's what happened then.
Wow. Can you chat to us a little bit more in detail about how our gardens play a valuable role in helping the environment? Like,
huge
climate change, biodiversity loss, all that sort of thing.
Massive role. The RHSI and the RHS in the UK have done research on this a couple of years ago. I remember reading an article about it. And we're becoming much more of an urban society, as we know, even in Ireland. And especially in the UK, there are large, you know, Manchester, London, all these big cities. There are, millions of people living in them. And each individual garden has a job to play. From the point of view of biodiversity, people are talking about biodiversity all the time now, which is just basically a jungle full of different types of plants, different types of flowers, different types of everything growing in spaces. And with that, with biodiversity, you're feeding the soil with biodiverse plants. We're giving off different signals to the soil. They're feeding so if you're constantly eating the same food all the time, even though it's really, really good food, after a while your body starts craving for something else.
Yeah.
And it's the same with the gardens. But the urban gardens have a huge part to play with the environment and what they offer, because we were very conscious of the soil and how it matters. I was looking at an old gardening book the other day, and it was talking about spreading some sort of chemical or potash thing on the lawn to get rid of worms.
Yeah.
What? You know, we have a heart attack. And, well, the reason why people don't like worms.
Why would you do that?
Well, in this time of the year, if you go out, you'll find there are little brown patches in your garden soil lifted up. And that's basically the worms pushing up the soil.
Yeah.
And what they're doing is aerating the soil, of course.
Yeah.
They're putting it, allowing air. We absolutely need them.
Yeah.
You know, and even our lawns, for example, you know, it's lovely to have a lovely, perfect, all green lawn. But when you have an all green lawn, you have what they call a monoculture. You have probably maybe one or two different types of grasses, but that's it. Whereas in a lawn that is allowed to have a few daisies in it, a few dandelions, a few this, that and the other, speedwell or whatever it is, that's a biodiverse lawn. And, even the moss can be a bit of a nuisance. You mightn't like it, but it has a place.
Does it?
Absolutely.
Tell me, because we're effectively like, we're on a bog, really. You know, I mean, it's like just this oasis that just keeps feeding water up. So sometimes I go out and go, if I was to cut this, and then we do cut it regularly, but sometimes you feel like you're cutting moss rather than actual grass.
Well, you can be.
Yeah.
But I mean, you really have to try and work with what you have.
Sure.
And what we're all the time trying to do in our gardens is manipulate nature. You know, we're trying to create something.
So
you know,
what does moss do?
Moss basically is a covering. It's it's soft covering on the and
so it protects. Yeah.
It protects the soil. But what it's most importantly doing when it's green, everything that's green is photosynthesizing, which means it's absorbing the sun's.
Well, it's lovely and green.
Energy.
That's good.
It is, but it's feeding the soil as well. And if we didn't have photosynthesis, if we didn't have the sunlight, we wouldn't have our lovely green. We wouldn't have our oxygen. You know, it's very, very important. So the more green you have in your garden, the better. And, you know, it's lovely to have some bare soil. I like looking at bare soil, when, especially when it's nice and healthy looking.
Yeah,
but really, 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 you should try and cover it as much as possible with plants.
And can I ask, we have spoken about this before, but the idea of using, you know, when you're, you know, kind of using weed killer or using whatever it is, that to try and use natural products, you know, and then even when we're trying to, you know, I suppose we're trying to fertilize the soil. We want to use manure and stuff.
At this time of the year, it's a good time to dig out perennial weeds that you have growing in your beds.
Yeah.
You know, you can't dig, you won't be able to dig them all out. But I mean, and yet again, dandelions are a fantastic source of nectar, pollen.
Oh, okay.
For bees at the beginning of the season.
Yeah.
So it's about a mix of everything.
The best of the morning show.
The Divine Mercy Conference has been going now for 29 years, and having experienced the infectious enthusiasm of Deacon Don Devaney, one of its organisers, I can understand why. I asked Don to explain what the conference is all about.
Okay, what it essentially, in a nutshell, God's mercy is for everybody, and everybody needs God's mercy. And 29 years ago, we were praying as a prayer group, and one of the people in the prayer group got this inspiration to say that she felt that Jesus wanted a conference on his divine mercy.
Wow.
And we were all amazed. We were saying, wow, well, that's certainly unique, and it couldn't come from any human thinking, because we wouldn't have thought of it in the month of Sundays.
Yeah.
And we said, okay, we said, right, then we better, and our spiritual director, Father Cahill Price, he said at the time, he said, well, okay, well, the right thing to do now is to pray and keep discerning and see that this is right, this is from God. 6 months later, this lady got another inspiration, and she came back and she says, Jesus is disappointed that no work has begun on this conference. So at that stage we decided, right, then let's take this serious.
Let's get going,
And that was it. Father Price said, right, but we need a premises. And he said, Don, go and get something, go and find something. So I came across the RDS. And by the way, we had £500 in our bank account at the time, £500. And the RDS, the whole conference came to 26,000.
I was just about to say, it's not a cheap place to be buying your lunch, let alone putting on a conference.
Absolutely, yeah. So because it was God's work, when the conference was over and paid for, we had exactly £500 left. He paid for every single penny, down to the very penny.
Isn't it amazing?
It was just...
Wow, what an adventure for you guys. That's fantastic. And you know, what always hits me is that there are many, many conferences on, and your conference, the Divine Mercy Conference, is always slammed. It's always packed, isn't it?
Yes, thanks be to God.
Yeah, so it's really... There's a real kind of... It reaches something to the very heart. I was thinking the way the kind of Sacred Heart idea back in the kind of 19th century kind of portrayed for the first time this Jesus who was all heart, and it looks a little bit gruesome now, to be honest, but at the time it was something very new and very powerful as a kind of a vision of God, of Jesus. And in the same way, this idea of Jesus with this mercy pouring out of him, it was such a powerful vision of him, you know what I mean? Gorgeous, you know, and pretty hit people's hearts, didn't it?
Absolutely. And then when you look at the Sacred Heart, like, it's such it has such a place in the Irish psyche.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Because it's been in every home in the country with a little red light, and in fact, the Divine Mercy is just an extension of that.
I've often thought that, you know, but as I said, you know, it's just sometimes when people look at it, like, you see, it's one thing for people who've grown up with that, but sometimes people look at the picture of that and go, what is that man doing with his heart on the outside? Yes, you know what I mean? It just looks a bit
Whereas,
like, there's something very modern about the iconography around, you know, Jesus with these two streams of light coming out of him. And, you know, somebody who was looking at it, who's no background, would look at it and go, wow, that's a powerful picture, you know.
And it is powerful because the artist, even, who Jesus said to St. Faustina, he said to her, you know, when the artist had painted the picture, she said, oh, it's terrible. You know, it's absolutely not nice to look at. And he said, look, that's not important. He says, whoever gazes on the image, the most hardened sinner, their hearts will be softened. by just gazing on the image without...
Because there's... when someone's... I think when someone really engages prayerfully as an artist... They, you know, something beautiful happens and people kind of almost, they hook into it and they kind of feel something themselves when they see something like that, you know. So we're talking 29 years. What do you think is the lasting appeal of the conference?
I think the prayer is the means of achievement, and I think prayer, Jesus is at the centre of everything, in the discernment, everything we do as a committee, everything we do. And the word we got in prayer was not to make any decisions, not to go forward with any decisions unless there's complete unity within the committee. Even if one person says, I'm not happy with that, it's not sitting right with me, we wait and pray and we say, okay.
That's a good biblical principle there, you know. That's lovely, don't do anything except through, you know, unity. That's really good.
Yes.
So is it an exclusively Catholic event?
No, it's not. God's mercy is for everybody, and everybody needs God's mercy. And Catholic means universal. So everybody's welcome. And, you know, it is a Catholic focus in that we have the sacraments, we have confession, we have Holy Mass, we have adoration. So it's if you like, it's very Catholic, but everybody's welcome.
Yeah.
But Jesus is at the centre of it, and our faith is at the centre of it.
So Don, what is the theme of this year's event?
This year's event, the theme is the last line of the Our Father, deliver us from evil. Yeah. Amen.
Yeah.
And as Father Pat Collins said last year, the country was facing a tsunami like of evil. Mm. And this is a response, if you like, that it's back to prayer, like when we see some of the stuff we saw recently, like that murder in Meath of that young boy. Like, I mean, that was just horrific, just evil at its worst. And unless people move back to pray, and that's what the conference is saying, deliver us from evil. And through moving back to Jesus, moving back to prayer, moving back to values, to Christian values, and I think only then will we have some semblance of peace and decency restored.
The Best of the Morning Show.
Davide Barbieri is from Turin in Italy, now married to an Irish girl and living and raising a family in Knock, County Mayo. You wouldn't think that he has come through a life of addiction that left him penniless and homeless. Here, Davide describes how he ended up on the streets.
I stopped selling drugs. I stopped being part of the criminal circle. And because I stopped in that, I didn't have money. I ended up homeless for 3.5 years on the train station of Turin. I was living by crime. Every day you have to find a bit of money to buy your drugs. And every day was like that for 3.5 years. So I lost all my teeth. I was weighing 40 kilos. So, you know what I mean? Long hair, long beard, same clothes for months, no washing, no facility. People around the city will walk by you and feel disgusted, you know?
That must be very, very hard, Davide. I mean, you went to, I don't know whether you take a moment during those times. You might be so, you know, out of it, and you might be so medicated that you never really get to really look at yourself. But did you ever have a moment where you went, how did this happen to me?
No, not really.
No.
I was so blind and deaf. You know, I call it like today, it was like the death of the soul.
Sure.
I couldn't see myself. I could not... I didn't have any hope, any dream. The only things I was hoping that one of the day when I used to take a lot of heroin, I will not wake up. Wow. That was my only hope.
You were actually hoping for death,
that,
really?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, so I'm just wondering, like, I mean, looking at the man in front of me and going, my goodness, wow, what happened to him? What was the turnaround?
The turnaround was after 5 attempts at suicide, the last one I was in a coma for a week. And attached to machine and stuff like that. I didn't have you know, like I said, did you see the light in the tunnel or stuff like that? But I woke up and there was a light in the tunnel.
Sure was.
And I start to unplug myself from the ICU. And I reached under the bed of the ICU where I was, and I found my jacket. And the first thing I found, I pull up the jacket, and there was a pack of cigarettes. And I light up a cigarette, and the whole hell broke loose because, you know, the nurse went ballistic, and she said, "Well, you don't just
smoking
want to,
in here.
You know,
there's
you
oxygen
just want to,
in here.
No, just killing yourself. You want to kill everybody." And they said, "You know," I said to them, "I feel great. I want to leave." And they said, "But you were dead for a week." And I said, "But oh, I'm great now. I want to leave." Now, Ronan, I left that day. The consultant that followed me on the five time I was brought to the same hospital in overdose, he said to me that morning, listen, David, he called me by my first name. He said, I don't know you, you don't know me. But I can tell you, after seeing you coming here five times, the God doesn't want you yet. The devil doesn't want you yet. So there is some things that you have to do in this hurt. I left the hospital on that day, and a memory came immediately in my head. That was August 1996, 24th of August, 14th of August, 1996. There was a man called Peter, a little man, a widower. He grew up his children, and every Monday night he used to come to the train station in Turin to one corner. He will go around the day collecting bread and ham and cheese, make sandwiches, and bring tea. Every time Peter will come, all the homeless will go to Peter. It was amazing. Peter never said to me once, look at the state of you. Look what you're doing with your life. Peter used to say, how are you, my son? Have you eaten today? And he'll give you a sandwich and a cup of tea, and you start telling him a little bit about your day, all miserable things. Anyway, Peter will listen. And he'll talk to everyone every Monday night, religiously. And at the end, when he move away, he'll say, Davide, if you have enough of this life, there is a place where you can go and start again. And he'll give you a business card of the community, Cenacolo.
Oh, Cenacolo.
Yes.
What a wonderful
And that
community.
Day, that night, after the hospital, I went home to my parents. They didn't see me for 3.5 years. I arrived home. My mother welcomed me on the threshold, and she said, what do you want? And I just said, Mom, I don't know. I didn't want to die on a train station. I came to die at home. My mother said, I wouldn't allow you to come in my house and die. The only way you can walk the threshold, that you promised me that you go to community Cenacolo. And I said, my mother telling me Cenacolo, that man telling me Cenacolo. So I surrender. I surrender and I tried. And it was the best thing I ever done in my life.
Now, what we know about Cenacolo is it's a very kind of active kind of life when you go in, isn't it? Because they get you working.
That was the last place I want to go, because they make you pray and work.
Exactly.
It wasn't that way.
Yeah.
But you see, that was in the back of my head. I arrived from the streets to my parents, and in 4 or 5 days, I was into the community Cenacolo. My welcome was by all these men from different parts of the world, and all smiling, all looking a little bit like me, with a bit more weight on their faces. And they didn't care who I was, who I was connected with, what was my addiction. They only care that finally I arrived to the top of the hill. The mother house is on the top of the hill in Italy. And I trusted.
And you found acceptance there?
Not on the first day, but I just said, I'll give it a go. In the back of my head, I say, you know, police were looking for me. You know what I mean? I had a lot of criminal charges. So I say, I'll park myself here for a bit and I take a chance. So that chance became 5 years of my life. After the first week I was in community, the police found me. They came to the Cenacolo community with an arrest warrant. So I was asked to go and change, because I was in work clothes, to show myself to the main office. There was 2 policemen and a guy in charge of the court case, the legal side of the community. And I knew they were looking for me. I knew who I was before I walked into this community. They showed me the paper and they say, you have to come with us. But the man said, no. It took him 11 years to get him in here. You're not gonna take him to prison. And I look at the man and I say, oh my God, I never see anyone speaking like that to a policeman. And the policeman just took the warrant, cut it in 4 pieces, and he said, now is your responsibility.
Wow.
And they took off.
Wow.
First miracle.
My goodness.
The man says to me, they're going. I vow for you, because I believe God wants you here. God, at that stage, wasn't really clear what wants for me. Mm. He said to me, God wants you here. I vow for you. But if you make trouble, I'll be the first one to call them to come and get you.
And did you believe him?
I didn't believe him, but I said, first time in my life, that someone will do something for the scum of the earth. He will vow his reputation for this bag of skin and bones.
Yeah.
And I was so grateful for that. And I enjoyed the community. I enjoyed the community every single day. It wasn't easy. You work very hard. You pray very hard.
Can I ask you, because, you know, what we have up till now is a real turnaround. Somebody cares. Somebody shows you a personal care. At what point did the penny drop that this God who loved, it was God who loved you and it was God behind this? When did that happen for you?
It happened very, I'd say, between the 3 and 6 months in community. It wasn't instantaneously, okay? And it became like at nighttime, they used to come and call you at 2 a.m. in the morning to go in front of the Blessed Sacrament in adoration. Like at the beginning, I didn't even know. I didn't want to get up. You work very hard during the day outside in farms. But they will come and keep coming back. And I decided, okay, I'll take a chance. I'll go. And I never turned back. So the first 3 months, they removed. So in Cenacolo, you can't have cigarettes, mobile phone, laptop, drink, anything from the world outside. So the only things you were fighting was purity, okay? And very difficult. So because everything else that can take your brain off reality has been taken away from you. So there is no escape route. So the only escape route will be inside you, so a purity. And I was struggling. And one night after adoration with this older guy in community, I felt that I need to say it to someone, because the first 3 months were very tough. My bags were packed every night. I want to go. But every time I knelt down in front of Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament, I felt a voice inside say, "And where are you going? You're not gonna live here for a girlfriend, for a job, for an apartment. You're gonna go live here because you're gonna go get heroin to kill the pain." So that night I said to this guy, that is a priest, this holy priest with the community Cenacolo, I said, "I'm struggling with purity. Make my life very hard." And he says to me, "Tomorrow morning when we pray the rosary, ask Our Lady to help you with that." And I did. And it never happened again.
Yeah.
Another miracle. But these things are self-will, belief,
yeah,
offering, sacrifices. But the turning point, as you say, was the confession.
The Best of the Morning Show on Spirit Radio.
Love in the Countryside is a new TV show that will be looking to help single men and women living in rural Ireland to find love, romance and companionship. I talked to casting producer Leo Wallace.
This upcoming TV show is run by Kite Entertainment, my old friend Darren, who has produced some of Ireland's most popular shows, such as Gogglebox Ireland, Ireland's Got Talent and Ireland's Fittest Family. So how did the idea for this show come about?
Well, I guess nowadays, from doing research calls with a lot of single people, that dating apps just seem to be not the way forward anymore. And especially then talking to people over the years of other programmes who are living in rural Ireland, they find it even tougher to meet people, even in a companionship or a friendship kind of way. You know, if they're quite isolated or due to work commitments, they just have no time. And then dating apps don't work because there's only so many people you can swipe right or left. So there's just nowhere for people to meet people anymore. And due to work commitments, as I said, Ronan, they just don't have the time.
And it's quite interesting. I do remember, even when, you know, even if you have a work commitment, if you're involved in a farm, my goodness, that can be really very, very intense. But even when they do, it's amazing. You go to a pub and everybody's in their phone.
Well, that's it, yeah. And people are not really communicating as well, you know. And I've been on the road now for the past couple of weeks chatting to so many people, farmers and just people who are living in remote areas like Achill Island or Valentia Island in Kerry. And the communication skills are just not there anymore. But from my research, people really do want to connect more. And people are lonely. You know, it's isolating out there, especially in the west of Ireland, and people are saying it's forgotten about now. So I guess we just want to bring a bit of romance into people's lives now.
Brilliant. So what way is the show going to work, Leah?
So basically, at the moment, what I'm doing is, as a casting producer, I'm looking to talk to people who are living in rural Ireland. And these people have to be committed to the land. So be it coming from a farming background, fishing background, or just, as I said, someone who's living in a remote area, but they just can't pack up and leave, you know, because of the commitment they have to the area they're living in. So I want to chat with them. We'll set up a dating profile for them, and people can get in touch with us if they want to date these people, and we'll go from there then.
Wow, that's very interesting. So it's a kind of dating show, really.
Yeah, well, that's it. You know, we're bringing back a bit of old romance. You know, people can contact these lovely people, be it writing a letter, a love letter maybe, rather than just swiping on your phone, you know.
So you're basically screening, really, is what you're doing. You're going out meeting people face to face.
Yeah, that's it. And I want to really hammer home that we're looking for all ages, you know. We particularly want to look for people who are a bit more mature, who maybe have never found romance, or else it's the second time around, you know. Maybe divorced or separated, or it just hasn't happened for them. So I definitely want to talk to people who are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and, you know, upwards, you name it. This is not Love Island. We're not looking for the 18 to 21-year-olds who just want to be on TV. We definitely want to chat to people who really want to meet someone and are just struggling because of where they live or due to their work commitment.
Absolutely. So how do they make contact with you?
So if they can email me, countrylove@kiteentertainment.com. So even if they just want to drop their name and their telephone number, and I'll get back in touch with them. Myself and my colleagues will be in touch straight away.
And you're going to go and have conversations with them if you feel like they've got good, you know, they've got good potential for the show, and you screen them so that other people don't have to.
Absolutely, yeah. We're doing all the hard work for them. Well, we know that these people are busy, so this is what we're trying to do, take all that pressure off them. So as I said, all ages, you know, anyone who's listening who thinks they're just too old to find love, that is not the case. I don't want to hear of it.
And when is it slated for broadcast for TX?
It'll be later this year. So there's a few things still under wraps, and maybe I can get back on your show and ask for more information.
No, that'd be absolutely brilliantly. We'd love that. So it's countrylove@kiteentertainment.com. And now you've heard Leah speaking, and she's lovely. So don't be afraid.
I'm really nice, and I genuinely want people to meet nice people. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really good. And thanks, Leah. Thanks for taking the time. Give our best to Darren in there. And,
I will.
Hopefully we'll talk to you later on the year.
Yes. Definitely. I'd love to come back on and tell you how we're getting on.
Great. God bless you.
The Best of the Morning Show.
Dr. Mark Dooley is a writer and philosopher who contributes regularly on The Morning Show. After a fascinating conversation on philosophical approach to voting in elections, which we won't talk about today, I asked Mark about a recent passing of an intellectual giant, Sir Roger Scruton, who was a personal acquaintance of Mark's.
Earlier this month, the respected philosopher Sir Roger Scruton died, and I know you knew him and you wrote about him. Can you tell us a little bit about him and his legacy?
Yes, he was I struggle to find an adjective to describe him. He was a polymath. He was a man of letters. He was the most intelligent man I have ever met. Of his 60 books, he wrote on a broad range of issues, music, architecture, sex, hunting, philosophy, politics, and so on. And his great contribution, I suppose, is to show that underlying the conservative vision of the world is not politics, but a philosophy. And a philosophy of belonging and settlement and home. Holding on to the things and conserving the things we love. Not for their own sake, but for the future generations. To show them how we've got from there to here. And that sense of belonging to a place that we can call home, that we can settle with the values and the customs which have been transmitted down the ages, I think is his greatest legacy. But, you know, I don't think anybody who is of a spiritual orientation in this day and age can afford to ignore him. I mean, his books, like the two in particular, The Face of God and The Soul of the World, try to show you how ordinary things like music, like architecture, like the environment, speak to us of spiritual things and sacred things. And when you look at the world that way, everything changes. So we buried him in Malmesbury last Friday, and what went down was a great man, but I think what has remained behind is this great vision, and it's not one that's going to go anywhere soon.
Yeah, he sounds like a wonderful man, a person I would have loved and very enjoyed to have met. If there was one of his books to read, what would you recommend?
Well, I would recommend one of my own, actually. I wrote three on him, but the last one was called Conversations with Roger Scruton, and it was published in 2016, and it goes through each facet of his... Well, we recorded it together over 3 days in his farm in Malmesbury. A farmer philosopher. He really, he acted out everything he believed. There was none, you know, most thinkers sit in university ivory towers, but this man, everything he wrote about, he did. He wrote against communism. What did he do? In the 80s, he went into Czechoslovakia, smuggled in literature for people like, you know, Vaclav Havel and so forth, who were the underground distance, was exiled, arrested, put into prison, beaten up, exiled from the country. But that didn't stop him. He then went to Poland, he went to Romania and forth and so on. So he really lived out the vision.
Yeah.
And so what I do in that book and Conversations is I take him through every facet of his life and his work, and we tease it out in a very kind of conversational, friendly tone. So I would go to Conversations with Roger Scruton, not only because it's a good book plug for me, but because it reveals the vision of a good life lived.
Well done.
The Best of the Morning Show.
What a fascinating interview we had with Katalin Novak last month. She's the government minister in Hungary, responsible for family and youth affairs. Steve talked to her about the serious demographic situation Hungary found itself in 2010.
Hungary is not in a unique situation. In whole Europe, there is a demographic problem, a demographic challenge. In Hungary, it's quite bad. It means that since 1981, we have had a decreasing population. We have lost like 10% of our population ever since. We had a fertility rate of 1.23 in 2011 when it was at the lowest. And we had declining marriage rates and also a huge number of abortions. So everything was quite bad at that time. And since then, we see some progress. We see some positive results, meaning that we have a fertility rate which is 20% higher than it used to be. We have a marriage rate which is higher than in the last four decades ever. We have the lowest divorce rate ever. We have the ever lowest abortion rate. So I think that we tend to move to the positive direction, but I'm very cautious with that. I'm an economist by profession, so I'm cautious with these trends.
Okay, so those changes obviously didn't happen just by accident or by chance. So what measures, what would you see as the key measures taken that has brought about this change?
I think there were two main aspects. One is the financial. I don't have to deny it that the financial part plays a very important role, because we would like to enable young Hungarians to have as many children as they want to have, when they want to have them, as early as they want to have them. So that's why we introduced many financial supports. We have a tax break for those who are raising children. We also have a subsidy for those who sign themselves for having children in the future. We also have a housing subsidy for those who want to have children in the future or who already raise children. We have a free daycare facility in the country all over. We have grandparental leave, for example. We have a total tax exemption for those mothers who have at least four children. And I could name and list these measures we have introduced in the last 10 years now. So these are important. These are the financial measures. But also there is this family-friendly environment, this family-friendly mentality we would like to support in Hungary. So having or not having children, it is also a question of culture. It is also a question of a family-friendly environment. If the community is able to encourage and acknowledge those who have children, who raise children, that is an important issue. And that is what is being shaped, I would say, in Hungary, not shaped by the government, but being shaped by itself. It is something that is happening, this change in Hungary. We are a very family-oriented community or society or nation by nature. But that is something that somehow changed in the last decades. And through this individualism, through the globalism, and through all these ideas, which just put the individual in the middle and forget the value of the community, forget the value of the family, forget the value of a nation or a society, those just somehow appeared also in Hungary. But now we see that those who have children and raise children in a responsible manner have more and more acknowledgement in Hungary by the society, by the groups of the society.
I'm sure lots of people are listening, thinking, oh gosh, we would love to have some of those measures here. And the whole thing of how family friendly society is, like how people are treated in public places if they have noisy children and things like that. These things don't change overnight, do they?
No, it goes very slowly. But, you know, fashion is a good thing because fashion can be anything. Having children can also be a fashion. So I don't think that we should do anything against fashion. We just have to make families and having children at a young age fashionable. Yeah. And that is what is happening in Hungary. Because, you know, when you're young and you see all your friends being alone, just on their own, and just caring about their own interests and their own joy, and that's it, and no children around, then maybe you will choose the same thing. But if you just realize that, come on, my best friends also just got married, and they have children, and they enjoy it, come on, that's a good thing, then let's try it out. And it goes like that, and it becomes a fashion. So more and more Hungarian young people get married. The marriage rate is at its 40-year high, so it hasn't been as high as it is right now in the last 40 years. And also they have children, and they want to have children and further children as well, and maybe large families, which is a great option. We don't force anybody to choose anything. We just give them the freedom of choice. That's what we would like to do.
Now, why is it important that a population replaces itself rather than relying on incoming migration from other countries?
Well, for me, this question is now something that we raise all the time, of course, but somehow it's not the question I would raise. I mean, I would raise it the other way around because, I mean, how come that a nation doesn't want to replace itself? I mean, doesn't want to grow, doesn't want to get healthier, doesn't want to get younger. I mean, that is what we by nature would like to do, is that we would like to be stronger as a nation as well, and we would like to be more and more, and that's our nature, just like that. And I think that's the question is what rises in Hungary, that until we have a so-called fertility gap, which is not a nice expression, but it means that until young people want to have more children than they will actually have at the end, that means that the Hungarian state has a task to fulfill, that we don't need any outer resources, we don't have to bring in any people from the outside, we just have to enable these young people to have as many children as they want to have, as they plan to have, and that's it. And if they could fulfill their dreams about having a large family, for example, then we could reach this fertility rate of over 2, and then we're fine. So for us, this is our main duty, to enable young people to have as many children as they want to have.
The Best of the Morning Show on Spirit Radio. Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.